Hello, I'm John Charles, and welcome to another virtual author chat at the Poison Pen Bookstore. Today, the Poison Pen special guest author is award-winning Deb Marlowe, whose new book, Death from Druid's Grove, comes out later this month. It's part of her series featuring detective sleuths Keir and Levitt. Before we begin, I'd like to let those listening in know the Poison Pen does have copies of both of Deb's new books on order. You're welcome to give us a call or go online. We would be happy to hold copies for you or put them in the mail. And now I'd like to welcome Deb Marlowe.
Thank you so much for having me, John. I would love to visit your bookstore sometime.
We would love to have you in person. But in the meantime, let's get to know you a little bit better. Why don't we start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself? Did you always want to be a writer? How did you initially get to the path of becoming a published author? Who was Deb Marlowe before she started writing?
She was a reader as a kid, right? Every writer was a reader first. I was obsessed with books. I loved historical books, especially. I really wanted to become a history major. We had a lovely, just a wonderful history department in my high school in Pennsylvania. And I thought, oh, that's what I want to do. Where I grew up, it was a depressed steel town in Pennsylvania. So I also knew I had to be very pragmatic and practical. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of my nature anyway. So, and I knew people that had gone the history major route and were just unable to find jobs. So I went to Penn State and got a bachelor's degree in nursing instead.
Oh.
And I figured I could always find a job doing that. And I met my husband while I was at Penn State, which oddly enough, we went to the same high school and never knew each other in high school, which is an odd thing, you know. But we met at Penn State, you know, in a crowd of 40,000, we found each other. So, and he moved to North Carolina a year. He graduated a year ahead of me, and I got married when I graduated and followed him down. And I was a nurse for several years in various different positions. I did, you know, mother baby labor and delivery nursing. I did some office work, all kinds of different things. But when my own son was born, he had health issues, and he could not go to daycare, so I was at home. And I thought, okay, here's my chance. I love to read. I've always wanted to write, and now I'm going to give it a shot. So I became a nap time writer. And I never stopped.
What was getting your first book published like? Because if I understand correctly, it was a lot different back in the day than it is today.
It was pre-internet, you know, days. I mean, the internet existed, but we weren't using it for business, you know, like we do now. So everything was done through the mail, you know, print off your giant manuscript and put it in an envelope and send it off. And and I have a really long driveway. So I would take the really long schlep down the driveway and pray that the envelope was small if it came back, which was asking for more or, you know, not your manuscript, a big thick one where they just send your manuscript back to you. That was always depressing. But, reading, I have always loved historical romance. Mm-hmm. I think my mom had every Jude Devereaux book ever written. My grandma read historical romance. She loved Dorothy Garlock.
Oh, yeah.
That was her favorite. And my mom, my grandma, my aunts, my great aunts, my neighbor, we all had a very unofficial sort of book club where we would just trade books and talk about what we liked and what we didn't. And my grandmother loved Dorothy Garlock partly because she was a little naughtier than the others. So it's always been about female bonding for me. But when I started to write, I found the Romance Writers of America back in the day. Mm-hmm. And that became a new sort of female bonding for me because I met, you know, writers who were starting out at the same time I was, you know, people who were ahead of me, you know, and, you know, I just made some lovely, wonderful friends that I still have to this day. So That was really a plus for me. But when I was really very seriously first started to pursue publication, I did the contest route, which I think there are some contests still out there to be entered. And I think it's a good idea to find a critique partner or to enter contests to get different perspectives on your writing as you're learning. And I took that feedback in and I just tried really hard to get better. And I started to win contests. I won like the Royal Ascot and the Golden Quill, different contests like that. And I was also submitting my first book at the same time. And I got the call, the big call. And what was really cool as a historical romance lover is the call came from Richmond, England. Harlequin Historicals called and wanted to buy my first book, which was lovely. It was honestly like a movie moment because, you know, here's this English accent on the phone. And she said lovely things like, I literally missed my stop on the tube because I was so wrapped up in your book, which I mean, you know, who doesn't want to hear that?
Yeah. Well, you won the Golden Heart, didn't you?
I did. And I did about 2 weeks later, I found out I finaled in the Golden Heart with my second book. So I actually sold the first book. And then 2 weeks later, found out that I finaled with my second book. And then the next, you know, spring, I won the Golden Heart. So, but I had already made the sale. Yeah, so.
And for those that aren't familiar with Romance Writers of America and their awards, the Golden Hearts and the Readers are kind of similar to the Edgars, if you're familiar with mysteries and things. So that was a big deal for you too. I mean, it's a competitive field and getting your first works acknowledged is a foot up, I guess.
It was. It was great. I got to go to the ceremony with my editor sitting beside me and she was there when I won. So that was great. And I mean, it was just a lot of recognition, I think, out of the gate that a lot of people don't get. So I was very lucky. I really felt very, very lucky and very grateful. So, and I tried to give back. I ran a few contests. I ran the Royal Ascot, and I also met more wonderful writers who finaled in that. And, you know, that I, again, still friends with to this day. And I've mentored several people that are now very successful authors too. So I appreciate all the help I got, and I do try to give back.
So you wrote a number of historical romances. That was your career for a while. Then you decided you wanted to write historical mysteries. Is that correct?
Yeah. It was just an itch I've always had. I cut my teeth on historical mysteries with Amelia Peabody.
Oh, yes.
Oh, who doesn't love some Emerson? Oh, my goodness. So I think I read all of those books and I love them so much. And I just branched out from there. And there's, you know, right now there's some really fabulous writers doing both, Jennifer Ashley and Andrea Penrose and, you know, I just, Sherry Thomas and, and I thought, well, why not give it a shot? Right. I love mysteries. I tend to watch a lot more mysteries than I read for some reason. Although I do have my favorite historical series, but I thought, why not? I'm going to go for it. So I did.
And is this the, and correct me if I get the names wrong, Kara Levitt and Niall Keir series?
Yes. Yeah. It's the Kieran Levitt mystery series. Okay. It's Victorian London. The first book is set in the during the exhibition of 1851, the Great Exhibition, which I've always been fascinated with. That is just such an amazing time, I think, in English history. And so interesting, the things that were there during that exhibition. And once I really started to dive in the research, I was even more fascinated and just really rich ground to use for that first book. And and now it's turning into a series and I'm thrilled. So
what can you tell us about your two sleuths? Because they're kind of fascinating in their own right.
Yeah, I love I love to make up characters. And sometimes I wonder where it all comes from. But, you know, I just start writing. Like, I'm one of those, I do sometimes talks on the writing process. And for me, I sit down and I have to figure out my characters first, is one of the very first things I have to do. And I really thought that the, I have two characters, Miss Kara Levette, who is an unusual Victorian lady. And she is an artist, and she is also kind of a scientist. She combines both in that she creates clocks and automatons. And I think you really have to draw from both sides of your brain to do that. And so she and also Mr. Niall Keir, who is also an artist, but he is a forge artist. He's got a Scottish background, and he creates art through his forge. And they both become exhibitors at the Great Exhibition, and that's where they meet, and that's where the first murder takes place, you know, only in, you know, my head, not in real life. But I don't think anybody really got killed in the Crystal Palace, but
not that we know of. And that they met because someone had stolen part of Kara.
They actually met the very first time they meet is when they're trying to get into to become exhibitors. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of research on all of this, and I was really fascinated by the fact that this really happened in history. They sent committees out to different cities to see, to have people come in and audition, because they wanted to show like the best of Britain, science, art, design, everything. They wanted the very best they could find. So they sent these committees out. And then after they had already made all their selections, one man who thought that he should have been somehow had missed his committee, you know, the nearby committee or hadn't had one. I never knew why, but he got in after the fact by going to one of the committee members and auditioning privately for him, and impressed him so much that the guy was like, yes, I'll make it happen. And so that is what I used for these two who have missed their chance, but they come at the same time, coincidentally, they come to this committee member and they're like, okay, look at what I have. And he's blown away by both of them. So that's the first time they meet. But then, so they're already kind of a little familiar with each other mm-hmm. when the murder happens. Yes.
And what I found fascinating was your heroine's creation of automatons.
Yep.
Automatons, yeah. Part of the reason she does that is because she's trying to help someone she knows who's missing a limb. Things like
that's how she gets into it to begin with. One of her tenants, she's a wealthy lady. She is the heir to a fortune. Her father was a baron. She does not have a title because when her father dies, it goes to the male heir. But he left her the fortune, and he left her the factories and the industries that they have been in charge of literally like since the time of Elizabeth, you know, Queen Elizabeth I. And so she's an only child. She had an odd childhood. I don't know how much I want to give away, but she's had a chance to learn more than the usual Victorian lady would have probably been allowed to learn. And she doesn't take that lightly, and she uses it as much as well as she can. And so, yeah, one of her tenants was missing a limb, and she's decided to try to make him one. Because at that time, they really had to choose between form and function. So you could have a dead kind of wooden hand mm-hmm. that looked like a hand, or you could have a hook or another tool. And there was no, the combination of the two were really just starting to be explored during in 1851. So I did a lot of research on that too. So I'm indulging my history loving side with this series.
Well, what's fascinating is I think a lot of people, myself included, don't realize how many discoveries, how what the, an explosion of scientific events was going on during the Victorian era. We have sometimes have this very narrow viewpoint of it as being just one way, but it's almost 100 years, I think.
It's so long. I mean, she ruled for so long, and they went from, it's, I feel like the kind of the same thing has happened to in our lifetime, you know. Yeah. And I feel like human history kind of has those speed up times, you know, where like everything happens so quickly. And that was definitely one of them, because, you know, I've written Regency. This is my first Victorian. Mm-hmm. I wrote Regency historical romance, I think 27 or 28 of them. And I feel like I know the Regency up and down. So I was kind of really thrilled to jump into a whole new era. And I knew the broad strokes, but I really get to dig down into the nitty gritty for this series. And I'm having a great time. But everything changed so quickly. And I mean, on every from, you know, fashion to science to chemistry to, you know, transportation and politics, everything was in flux.
Yeah, it's so amazing. And you can tell that you're a lover of history, because that comes through in your writing. There's a lot of details, a lot of fascinating things. And what I found really interesting was you had written about doing research for the first book in the Crystal Palace, and about things that people would be amazed to learn were actually occurring during the Victorian era. And one of them was fizzy water. And you mentioned Schweppes, and I'm thinking, well, I've seen that in the store and things like that, but who knew that was like 150 years or something ago?
Yes. It was Schweppes actually got a royal seal from Queen Victoria. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When she was first made queen, she had already loved their sparkling water, and she gave them a royal seal, and they actually still have, one of the centerpieces of the Crystal Palace was a crystal fountain, and it was in the barrel vault of this, you know, tall scented sparkling water in this fountain. And they actually still use an image of that fountain on their label. So it's amazing the things that they had back then that you would think, surely that's new, right? Like my refrigerator is full of flavored sparkling water, right? But nope, they were doing it back then.
That is amazing. Which brings us to the next book, which comes out later this month, Death from the Druid's Grove. What can you tell us about your two characters in this book without spoiling anything?
Without spoiling anything. Well, they solve a murder. So we discover in the first book that Niall is a member of a secret society called the Druid's Grove. And we don't really know much about that. It's run by a magistrate in one of the police courts. But he is also somebody who is wealthy, but doesn't want to be bored. And so he actually goes into being a judge and a sitting magistrate, just out of like wanting to contribute something to life. But he has a fascination with the Druids and their ideals and the way that they spread knowledge and the way that they encouraged music and you know, community. And he wants to do that, and he's created this this community. And Niall, as I said, is a part of that, and in the second book Akara gets invited into it, and that's where some of our shenanigans start.
I'm not that knowledgeable. I know I've heard of Freemasons, and I know that they go back centuries and things like that. Were secret societies kind of a big deal in the Victorian era? Was there like lots of them, or?
They've always been around. I mean, even in the Georgian area, even pre-Regency, they had the Hellfire Club, right?
That's right.
So I think they've always been around. In Victorian London, there were quite a few clubs that had to do with not learning, but more physical stuff. Sex clubs. Yeah. There were quite a few sex clubs in Victorian London. But I think that, but you know, the idea of, you know, if you look even on Bond, you know, all the clubs on Bond Street, right? Whites and Boodles and all those, it's they've always been, I think, a part of English life. So I felt super comfortable creating my own and making it part of the fabric of London. So
you've talked a little bit about your research. Do you have certain sources that you turn to when you're researching an era? Do you have print sources that you favor? Do you talk to, how do you do your research for your books, I guess, is the main focus of the question.
I have a ton of research books. I prefer to do all of my fiction reading on my iPad. But if I'm going to do research, I want the book in my hand. You know, I want the illustrations. I want, you know, the deep detail, because even though I don't use the vast majority of the detail that I figure out, it informs my brain, you know, like I have a really complete picture of what I'm looking into, hopefully, fingers crossed. And that just really helps my writing, I think. It helps me inhabit the world. And I want my readers to inhabit the world. So I feel like I need that level of knowledge. And I try to be very judicious in how much I dribble out as entertainment, because none of my books, I want them to be a slog through history. I want it to be, you know, a rollicking good time. So I am careful about including it, but I also want the reader to feel like they are there if I can possibly make that happen.
Well, I know that you've also included notes and things like that for readers when they're done with the book. They can go to your website and other places to find out more of the backstory.
Yes, if you go to my website, I have lots of articles on different aspects of history. I tend to include them in a lot of my social media posts. You know, why not? I mean, if you're a history lover, if you're reading historical romance, I think you are a lover of history, you know, and I think as a reader, I love to find out something new in a book like that, you know, and go, oh, you know, so I hope I'm making that happen for my readers too.
You've now written historical romance, you're writing historical mysteries. As a writer, did something need to change in the process? Because there is a difference between writing a love story and writing a mystery. There's certain structural elements that need to be in both stories. Was that a big switch for you? Did you just kind of seamlessly move from one genre to the
other? I had to really work at it, you know? I mean, it's, I wouldn't say it was seamless. I really have to rein myself in. Mm-hmm. On the romance, because this is, you know, this is a in a mystery series, I think traditionally it is a very, even if you have a romance, it's a very slow burn. Mm-hmm. Even though Amelia and Emerson got married in the first book, after the first book, yeah. the actual romance, you know, is not the focus the way it is in my historical romances. But I also, since I was a kid, you know, the romance is what is one of the things that draw me, even if it's not in a romance book. You know, I'm one of the millions of little girls that was like so interested in Laurie and Joe, and you know, and Little Women, and you know, Trixie and Jim and Trixie Belden, right? Now there was my first true love mystery series. I loved Trixie Belden. Jim started my lifelong fascination with redheaded men. So, but, you know, I have to be careful. In the first book there, it's really a getting to know each other period. You know, there's not a lot of time for romance when you don't really know each other. And you're also, you know, running around London from balls to the stews, you know, solving mystery, a murder. So, you know, it would be not natural for it to be a big thing, I think, in that book. But as the series develops, I get to add more romance in, and that makes me happy. And I'm still having lots of adventures. I'm still having a mystery that I hope is super interesting to solve, but I'm getting to add in some more of that level of, you know, emotion.
As a writer, you've written for big publishers like Harlequin. You've written for smaller presses like you currently are now. I'm not sure, have you also indie published? Is that
a lot? I've indie published a lot. Yes.
You're kind of the hybrid writer that we now see a lot in the marketplace. How do you determine when you're working on a project, this is something I want to be in control of, this is something I want to shop to a publisher? What is the process involved for you from the creative side?
Well, specifically with this series, you know, I was shifting to an entirely new genre, and I thought, well, I would like maybe I would like some support doing that, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and that was kind of the driving force behind submitting this to Dragonblade, who mm-hmm. has, you know, a lovely, lovely audience all, you know, built in to their as a publisher. And it's, you know, I was like, well, why not give it a shot? Why not try something different? I had been indie pubbing for a long time. I love indie pubbing. I do kind of, it is kind of addicting. Keep finding control, getting your fingers on top of everything. But, you know, there's also, you know, it's also great to just kind of let the rest of the stuff go and just concentrate on the story too. So there are good pros and cons, I think, to all kinds of publishing, and I want to try them all. So that's what I'm doing.
I think you've mentioned there's going to be more in the series.
There is. The third book is Murder on the Mirrored Lake, and it comes out in August.
Oh, okay.
So, and then we'll figure out where to go from there. I'll have to talk to the publisher. So,
yes, that partly depends on sales and things like that.
Right.
You have been writing for a while now. If you could go back to when you were first starting out, based on everything you've learned as a writer, what would you tell yourself?
Write faster. But, you know, actually, no, it would have been a smart thing to say to myself. But, you know, my kids were in elementary school when I sold my first book. And, you know, I had friends that didn't have those kinds of commitments, that did write faster, that are further along in their careers than they are now. But I still wouldn't have changed that. So, but, I mean, you know, I wanted to be there. And I want, you know, that was the beauty of having this career. You know, I was free to do all the mom things, you know, as well as write. And it was really a perfect way for me, I think, to raise two really amazing kids. So not patting myself on the shoulder there. They're amazing in and of themselves. But now I have more time. So, you know, they're grown men. So I have more time now, and now I'm doing things like exploring, you know, new genres and that kind of thing. So, but I don't know. I don't feel like I made steps that I would have changed. Mm-hmm. Trying to think about that, because it's a really good question. But I'm pretty happy. I'm pretty happy with how it's all turning out. So
a rarity in publishing. So that's something to celebrate. I think you mentioned you've been mentored. You've done mentoring of other writers. Did you also, you've also taught writing? Is that correct? Or?
Only in workshops, in conferences, or like in RWA, or even like last year I helped out with a writing track at the historical romance retreat in California. So I keep my hand in, you know, with that kind of thing.
What is the best advice you would give to someone who's just starting out as a writer? What would you tell them?
Just write a lot, read a lot, and write a lot. That is the very best thing you can do, I think, if you want to be a storyteller. And also watch people. People are fascinating. I think people are fascinating. And just, you know, learn from them, you know, pay attention to motivations. I have friends who are not, you know, outside my writing world, who, you know, might be telling me a story of something that happened to them. And, you know, and I sometimes will like drill it down to the super bare essentials, and they'll go, oh, yes, that's exactly right. And I'm like, yeah, it's just human nature, right? You know? And I think as writers, you have to be a student of human nature. And I think you also have to be a student of story. Like I'm addicted to story. I will watch it, read it, listen to it, any of it, if it's good. And I think that's also a really important thing to do.
Do you subscribe to the theory that there really are only 8 plots out there? It's just how you tell them that makes the difference.
I do think that there are basic themes that humans respond to.
Okay.
I don't know if there are 8 or however many of them are there, but I really think every writer brings something unique to the table. When I was learning, voice was a very important thing, right?
Yes.
And people will say, I just don't understand voice. And I'm like, okay. So if you pick up a book and you start reading and you go, oh, I know exactly who wrote this. That's the easiest explanation of voice. Mm-hmm. I could pick up a Mary Bellog book and go, oh, it's Mary. I love her. I love these books, you know, anywhere in the world, you know, and so try to develop your own voice, pay attention, to, you know, tropes are a big thing in romance. And why? Because they work, because people respond to them. And, you know, and I think mystery, you know, is the same way. There are conventions that readers feel comfortable and want to re-experience again and again. So definitely pay attention to that, but also bring your own spin and your own voice. And I think that is what makes a success.
I think you're very perceptive about voice. I think now a lot of times it gets packaged as an author's brand or something like that. But how you talk.
I know, you know, there are plenty of authors that have a brand that don't have a voice, I think.
Yeah. Well, that publishing sometimes doesn't distinguish between reality and perception and things like that. But yeah, no, voice is how you tell your story. That's, as a reader, either I connect with the book or I don't. And it's how the author tells the story. And that has nothing to do with the author's talent or skills or anything like that. It's just us.
Yes, exactly. And if you, especially if you have a strong voice, I think some people just aren't going to like it. Mm-hmm. And that's all right. They're not for you. You know, they're not one of your readers, but there are going to be plenty of other people that will. So.
How would you describe your voice to someone who's never read your books?
Well, I can say how I want it to be. I want it to be rich, and I want it to be kind of transportive. Mm-hmm. I want to take you on a trip. I want to take you on a journey. So that's how I hope it comes across. You know, if you don't like me, maybe you think I'm just a little wordy. I don't know.
That would be, I think you're immersive. You want to immerse the reader in a period, in a setting, in a story. And yeah, there's definitely some readers that don't want to, they want things pared down to an outline,
yes,
something like that. They're more,
yes,
for plot, or they want the twists and the turns. But yeah, you're definitely, there's layers to your stories and things like
that's what I'm shooting for. So thank you. That's what I love. That's what I want in a read, right? Or a binge watch or whatever. So that's what I'm hoping to deliver. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Let's talk a little bit about your writing process, because if I remember correctly from my research, a lot of authors have a dedicated space, but with you, it changes.
It does. I do have a dedicated space. I have a series of dedicated spaces, really. Because my kids were small when I was first starting to write, I love my kids. I do. I adore them. But you know how little kids are. They are not interested at all in you unless you start to become absorbed in something else. And then they must have your attention, right? That's the way my kids were. So they were really not interested in me unless I sat down at the computer, and then they wanted it. So I really started, my very first writing space was in my car. I would say bye-bye to mommy. And I would get in the car and I would drive. We live on a long cul-de-sac, and we have a driveway in the front and in the back. And so I drove all the way around to the back driveway and parked back there and write. And my husband would watch the kids. And so then he felt bad for me. So we got a little shed and put it out back there. So I would go out and work in the shed. And the kids were not allowed in the shed unless they had permission. So I would oftentimes they'd go outside and play. I live in North Carolina. We have really long play time, you know, beautiful springs, hot summers, long falls. So a lot of outside time. And so I would work in there and they would play in the yard. We have a large yard and plenty of room for them to run around. And so, you know, and then they would come run into the door and not come in. So the only problem was there was no temperature control. So winter became an issue out there. Yeah. So eventually I did get my own dedicated office space, but I can't write every book out there and I have no idea why. My husband, when I start a new book, he'll say, "Where does this book want to be written?" And I'll go, "I haven't figured it out yet," because some books want to be written at the kitchen table and some want to be written in my office and some want to be written. I still sometimes go right in the car, honestly. I mean, if I'm really stuck or just need to concentrate really hard, I will just go sit in the car. And there's just something about, like, I did so much carpool writing and sitting and waiting at practices, you know, it's just, I've always done a lot of writing there. So sometimes just changing it up will jumpstart the process. So, but, the book I'm writing now is a kitchen table book. So,
what is Deb Marlowe's Regency Kitchen? What can you tell us about that?
Okay, so I love to cook. I absolutely adore the Great British Baking Show.
Oh, yes.
I mean, oh my gosh, a new episode of that comes out and I just sit there and like grin like a fool all the way through the episode, right? And so I decided, all right, I'm going to do some historical recipes in my modern kitchen. So I started making these completely amateur, in no way professional videos where I would often take a recipe from one of my books, like that something a character ate or something a character loved, and I would make them on these videos and I put them on my website and people can go there and watch me make, you know, chicken and leek hand pies or, you know, syllabub. Like, we all want to know what syllabub is, right? You've read about syllabub in so many historical romances, but who really knows what it is? Well, I'm going to show you what it is. So it is just a bunch of silliness, but I really have a lot of fun with them. And I also get to share the history behind the recipes, which is also another plus for me. So
one other question I had was, because I'd never heard this referenced, and you had said something to another person about when you were talking about your reading interests. I have no idea what the Motoring Millers are.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I told you I was completely obsessed with historical books. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where it was, like, you know, it was in the school library. Oh, I don't even remember when they were published, but they were all about the Midwest in like the 1920s. And it was like a little town, I think it was in Kansas. It was a little town in Kansas, and it was just young. It was a kid, they were kids' books, and it was, and they were, and it was something I found in my school, elementary school library. And I just loved them. There were three books, It was just about this, you know, these two girls that they were, they had lost their mother and they were moving to this new town. Their father was a college professor, and it was right when cars were first becoming an actual thing. And so they were like the first people in this town to have a car. So like it kind of set them apart or whatever, but it was like it's one of those things where it was like, they did really interesting things. Like they explored, I learned about new things in history, like Chautauqua talks, which were these traveling, lectures where people would put on their Sunday best and go watch a traveler talk about his time in Egypt with slides and everything and that kind of thing, and Pike's Peak, and they would travel to different places and I would learn about new places. And so it was only three books, but it was like one of my obsessions when I was a kid, you know. So, and I actually went and found library copies and bought them. So I have them on my shelf now because I'm like that.
Before we run out of time and we're rapidly approaching that point, how can readers learn more about your books? Are you on social media? I think you've mentioned a website.
Yes. If you are a history nerd like me, definitely go to my website. You can read about different articles. I have articles posted there. I have behind the book things behind on there, just about different facets of history that I find interesting and that I've used in my books. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. I'm not on TikTok, even though everybody tells me I need to be. And I'm like, I don't know when that would happen, but I'll look at it eventually. When I have time. Facebook and Instagram are the biggest ones, and my website. I do have a reader group on Facebook, a private reader group. If people are interested in joining, just a lovely group of people. I mean, we interact every day. We've become close, you know, we kind of know each other's lives. We've been together so long. So, it's not a super big group. It's smallish. And I kind of like that because I like to spoil them. I do special games and stuff with each book and send out lots of presents and stuff. So if you're, you know, really like Deb Marlowe, then let me know and I'll add you to that group. But otherwise, you know, friend me on Facebook or Instagram or come visit me on my website or shoot me an email at deb@debmarlowe.com. I do have readers that share stuff with me that I just love, like all kinds of things, you know, confirmation pictures and all kinds of fun stuff. So,
well, we've rapidly come to the end of our time. I'd like to thank Deb Marlowe for joining the Poison Pen for a virtual author chat. Her new book is A Killer in the Crystal Palace. Coming soon is Death from the Druid's Grove, historical Victorian set mysteries. Thank you, Deb. I look forward to another wonderful mystery from you and possibly some more romances.
Yes to all of those. Thank you. Thanks, John, for having me. It's been really fun.
Thank you. And thank you for those listening in to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.